podcast where we put you on the map. This is Ron Costa broadcasting live from the Mappable USA Studios in Las Vegas, Nevada. And folks, we had the VP debate last night. We're talking about an election coming up. We've got COVID. We're going to tie this all together in today's show and talk about real estate as well. To do that, let's bring in Vicky Hutchmala from the worldtokenmarket.com. Vicky, how are you today?
Doing great, Ron. It's perfect in Vegas because now the temperatures are going down, so this is why we live here for this time of the year. And we have our favorite guest for a podcast, Neil Bawa. So let's get started. We have lots to talk about.
Absolutely. Let's bring him on. I call him the doctor of demographics or the master of multifamily, Neil Bawa. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. Thanks to be back on the show, Ravon. And, it's always fun to kind of go through lots of interesting topics with you and Vicky. So delighted to be back.
Yeah, I'm happy that you're back on as well. Your shows always do great. Everybody wants to hear more about what you got going on. And, Neil, I know you do a lot of webinars. You do a lot of different topics. I don't know how you find the time to do it, to tell you the truth, because you're all over the place. And I'm just really impressed with the content that you put out there. It's phenomenal. It's top-notch. Really good stuff.
Thank you. I think a lot of it is because I come from a family of teachers. So wife's a teacher, mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister-in-law, my mom, myself, have all got teaching experiences. So when we're doing webinars, a lot of that experience comes to bear. So you have to really like doing something like webinar. It has to be something that's emotionally satisfying for you to do it, because, obviously you're not getting a financial value out of it. And yeah. I do get that aha, that benefit, that, great feel when my, attendees, webinar attendees have an aha moment when they enjoy the process. So it's very gratifying.
Oh, we certainly do. We certainly do. Every time we attend one of your webinars, I learn something, and Ron gets so excited. It's like Christmas for him every time he.
Well, I got to tell you, Neil, when you see a movie, like your favorite movie, you watch it again, like The Godfather or something you really enjoy, and people say to you, why are you watching that movie again? You know what it's all about. You see it happen every time. That's kind of the way I feel sometimes when I listen to your webinar, especially the location magic one. I don't know how many, tracks you do on those, but a lot of them are mine. I'm out there doing my walk, or I'm listening to location magic in the background saying, I got to hop on a plane or something.
I like that.
So anyway, there's nothing that feels better than helping people to learn something that they didn't know, or to expand what they did know, like Ron, and look at it from a different point of view. That's, what could be better than that?
I think it's really about point of view. A lot of people are looking at, okay, I think I know X, but what are different ways of looking at X? And it's knowledge is useful, but point of views are priceless.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. And now before we get into our conversation with the election and everything, why don't you tell people again what Grow Capital is and multifamily? You're just going to remind them in case they didn't listen to the last time you were on the show.
Sure. So we are a bunch of technologists, nerds, geeks, dorks, that live in Silicon Valley, and we buy real estate, multifamily, student housing, storage, and industrial properties throughout the United States. We also build them throughout the United States. Around the portfolio is around $320 million. About 500 active investors are invested with us, and they like us because they're just as geeky and dorky as we are. The focus is always on numbers and metrics and measuring everything, right? That's our key focus, because when we came in from technology a long time ago, we looked at real estate and we realized that a lot of the metrics were lip service. People were using them to justify their positions as opposed to justifying the best places to invest in, the best assets to invest in. So we determined that our mission would be to truly be focused on numbers, to truly look at that data. And then our secondary mission would be to educate people about those, regardless of whether they were investing with us or not. So now Multifamily University gets about 50,000 people a year that come to our events to learn. Actually, we have an event tonight, and we have over 1,000 people registered. This is a event about taxes, obviously, with the elections coming up. Taxes are a hot topic. And then I did one 2 days ago that I had about 1,400 people registered for, which was a focus on the real estate opportunities that you might not think of that are coming out of the COVID pandemic. So the fact that we have 50,000 people a year benefiting, you know, 500 of them become investors, and that's great. That's all we need to make a good living. That's very gratifying to be able to, you know, enjoy benefits from, you know, the 1% and to give benefits to the remaining 99%. That's what Multifamily University is there for.
Yeah, that's special. That's really special.
Yeah.
So let's start with how the virus, that it seems like we've been enduring this forever, but over the last few months, what do you think the impact of the virus is on real estate investing overall, multifamily or otherwise?
So it's varied, right? So it's varied across asset classes. When you look at real estate, a lot of people just think single family. And if I had to say single family, I'm going to start there because it's the one that people think of most. I think it's a positive impact. I know that sounds horrible given 210,000 people are dead, but the impact has been positive because the interest rate cuts, had a massive impact. You can basically now in certain parts of the U.S. buy 30% more house. And so some people are buying 30% more house because they want an extra room because of the pandemic. And other people simply have gone from being renters to becoming homeowners. They had given up on becoming homeowners because, you know, when they looked at that final amount, they wouldn't qualify. They couldn't get a bank loan. Now a lot of those people at the current interest rates, they go back to the bank and the bank's like, yeah, you qualify. So there's, you know, all of a sudden we've taken a couple million Americans and moved them from cannot buy to, yep, they can buy. And as a result of that, we are seeing some incredibly red hot real estate markets in the U.S. I really can't think of any markets in the U.S. where real estate prices are going down. They're pretty much all going up. Amongst the top 50 markets that are two that are hurt. And the moment I mention them, you'll know exactly why. So those two big markets that are hurt are San Francisco and New York. Both of them for the same reason. There is currently an exodus of people out of those markets. Both markets have seen rents fall by levels greater than 2008. Both markets are seeing vacancy higher than 2008. And both are seeing, you know, basically a very large number of properties on sale, much larger than 2008 as well. So both markets suffering. We don't know for sure whether their suffering is long-term or short-term. There's two groups of people. One group says, hey, when COVID's over, people will come back. The other group is, no, I think that this is a long-term thing. This is a trend. And it was already there before COVID, and COVID accelerated it. I am in that second group. I believe that San Francisco and New York, some of those people will come back, sure. I mean, we're not saying 100% won't come back. In fact, even if 75% comes back, I'm still in the second group, because that 25% that don't come back will forever change real estate values in San Francisco and New York. Now, on the other side, we are seeing people going to cheaper markets because now we have what COVID did. Yes, 210,000 people dead, a million people dead worldwide. That is an enormous impact. But for a moment, if we step beyond the healthcare impact, COVID has been the single largest business impact, the way we work, since World War II. Because in 1 5-month time frame, we trained 3 million CEOs how to run their business from home. And can you imagine, some of them actually were surprised to find out that they liked it. Some of them were surprised to find out that they were good at it. Some of them were surprised to find out that their companies ran better and cheaper and faster in this mode. They wouldn't have done it. If you had put a gun to their head, they wouldn't have done it. But when a pandemic happens and it forces all of society to do things a certain way, it changes society. It's a switch that could have never been thrown by any president or any party, but the switch got thrown. Now you can't unthrow the switch. So as a result, we have a substantial percentage of America's CEOs that today think differently than they did on March 1st. They think differently. They behave differently. Their decision-making is different. Their boards, their chairmen, they all think a different way. And as a result, society goes through a change. And some of these smaller metros are the primary beneficiary of this huge change because people are saying, I have two options. I'm not going to live in San Francisco anymore and pay $4,500 for a one-bedroom apartment. I have two options. One is suburbanization, which is a key trend. So they're saying, well, instead of living in San Francisco, I'm going to go live in Tracy. And Tracy is about 60, 70 miles from San Francisco. It's a two-hour drive into San Francisco. And I'm going to talk to my boss and say, look, you know, I can only come into the office once a week. Before this, most bosses would be like, are you kidding me? No. You can work from home once a week. But today bosses are like, okay, maybe you can do that. All right, so how about you come into work once a week and four times a week you work from Tracy? So that paradigm has shifted. So now people are like, I'm going to go to Tracy. That's one. That's suburbanization. And the second trend is they're saying, I just don't want to live in the San Francisco Bay Area anymore. I'm going to go look at all of these places in the United States that I've loved, that I've traveled to. I've been to Charleston, South Carolina, and I loved it there. Provo, Utah had incredible skiing, and, you know, home prices were, you know, one-fourth of the cost of San Francisco. And then I also loved living on the beach in this place, Coeur d'Alene, beautiful. Look at the natural beauty of Coeur d'Alene. Now you have the choice to go do that. And it isn't just that you stay with your employer. It's that so many other employers today will accept the fact that you live in Coeur d'Alene and work for a company in Austin, where 5 months ago they simply wouldn't accept it. So now we have a national market for labor, where we only had a local market for labor 6 months ago. And so as a result, these smaller cities are big winners. And also bigger metros like Phoenix are cheaper metros, right? So Vegas, Phoenix, Orlando, Houston, these are cheaper metros. And I think that the future is brighter for them. And so that is the big change in real estate. But going back to single family, in general, it doesn't matter where you are in the United States, except for San Francisco and New York, you're a beneficiary because we are seeing ever low interest rates. And a Federal Reserve, that for the first time in history, is actually telling us what the next 3 years are going to look like on interest rates. You know, that was the closest guarded secret that the Fed had. They would not even, you know, share the minutes of their meetings because they were afraid that the market would start to price in interest rate cuts or hikes. Today, they're giving us 3 years of forward-looking guidance. Well, that's great news for the real estate market because we can all make decisions knowing that interest rates are going to stay at, I don't want to call these ultra-low rates because that was a while back. Today, the rates are, you know, just unbelievably low, shockingly low, right? There has to be a different word for it because we've used ultra low before too many times. And so not only having those rates, but having forward-looking guidance that they will stay low for a long time is very bullish for real estate. But the situation is more muddy on other asset classes in real estate. For I really can't think of a negative on the single-family side. Yes, there's some tenants are not paying rent. And we're seeing this nationwide rent moratorium, and so there's some pressure on landlords. But generally what we've seen is because of the 2008 pandemic, the landlords of America today are much richer than they were in 2008. 2008, we had all these farm workers who were basically buying $400,000 homes without stated income. The people who own these homes today are much more affluent. They can sustain the hit of not getting rents or getting smaller amounts of rents from tenants. And so I don't think the market will crash because of that. There's going to be a little bit of downward pressure in some of these big blue markets like California where renters are taking more advantage of this. As you can imagine, you know, the Democrat markets, we are seeing tenants take advantage. Chicago is a market where a lot of tenants have just simply stopped paying. But in most markets in the U.S. that are well-run, people are paying. And these you know, rent moratoriums and eviction moratoriums, they have catches. A lot of people are like, oh, yeah, nobody has to pay rent. No. Have you really read the law? Rent's not forgiven, right? It's just being pushed out to the future. And then there's a whole set of things. There's a whole set of steps that you have to follow. They're not easy steps. So you can't just bullshit your landlord and say, I'm hurt. You have to actually provide proof. It's sworn testimony. You're committing perjury. You could go to jail for this, right? And they make it very clear in the documents that you could go to jail for this if you lie to them. So some people have simply said, you know what? Yeah, I, you know, my job's not happening, but my wife still has a job, I'm going to still keep paying my rent. So overall rent payment in the U.S. is very high, and it's especially high for single-family rentals. You might say, no, Neil, I mean, I would think that it would be higher for multifamily. That's not what I'm seeing. Single-family tenants generally had more money. You know, if you have less money, you go live in an apartment. If you have more money, you go live in someone else's house as a tenant. So those are more affluent tenants. They had more months of, you know, rent in the bank. And so we really haven't seen a substantial default rate for single-family landlords. So, again, not a big downside. I think it's a big upside with a tiny little downside, right? And so overall, I think that the single-family market's doing phenomenal. Where it's bouncy, where it's kind of muddy is on the multifamily and the commercial side, and we can talk about that next if you like.
Yeah,
well,
and
the virus has causing ancillary impact as well, not just on the multifamily, single family residences, but also on the job market, on the economic development. It's impacted a lot of areas around just real estate.
Yes, and it's funny you said that. I mean, jobs, right? I want the viewers to think about this. Right now, when you go read in the newspaper, the United States is at 9% unemployment, right? And so you're thinking, oh my God, we were at 3.5% unemployment. We're now at 9. Therefore, there's 2.5 times as many people that are out of a job. And they start equating that with 2.5 times as much money that people don't have in their pockets. And the answer is, that's wrong. This is a strange sort of recession that the people who've made the least amount of money in America, the people that worked in retail and in hospitality, these are people that were low-wage earners. The recession has disproportionately affected them. Where are the technologists out of work? Where are the finance people that are out of work?
Where are
the high-end professionals that are out of work? So I invite you for a second to put your heart aside, because your heart obviously goes out to these people, and understand that purely from a logic and money perspective, the United States does not have 9% unemployment. If I had to make a guess, I'd say we went from 3.5 to 5 or 3.5 to 6, because the people that were affected were at the lowest end of the totem pole. Whereas somebody who works for Google and makes $225,000, I know this is a best case scenario, none of those people are affected. In fact, their lives have become simpler. They have more money because they're not spending a huge amount on gas. Some of them have been able to move from the San Francisco Bay Area to Austin, still make almost the same amount of money or the same amount of money, and have a lot more money to spend. So when we are looking at retail sales in the United States, did you know that in August, retail sales in the U.S. grew 5.6% over last year? Over last year. I'm not comparing it to over last month. I'm saying a year ago, we look at the sales, and we look at the retail sales in August, they were up 5.6%. And so one of the key things to understand is, while this recession is absolutely horrifying for the people that are laid off, right? I mean, we are talking about a huge number of people laid off. They were the least purchasing power in the United States. So from the perspective of how many dollars were being spent in March to how many dollars are being spent today, the difference might be 5 or 6%. And that is not something that's clear to most people, because they don't look at the details.
Well, and also, you know, the people who had the money and weren't as impacted, their life changed because, like you said, now they work from home, now they live in cheaper areas, they don't have to drive, they don't have to spend so much on gas, be on the road so long, but also it became more convenient for people to buy things because they didn't have to leave their homes and go buy it. They could just order it online and have it delivered, so they ordered more stuff because they could afford it.
Yeah, that explains why retail sales in the United States are 5% higher, right?
Exactly.
You know, we've now had a huge set, just like I gave you my examples on how 3 million CEOs' lives have changed forever, right? Here's another set of people whose lives have been changed. These are the sort of people that, you know, they knew how to get their way around an iPad. They knew how to use their phones. But they were never really comfortable buying everything from the internet. So their version of buying things from Amazon would be, oh, I'll buy a book from Amazon. I'll buy a CD. You know, occasionally I'll go out and buy something that only Amazon does, like Alexa's. But they weren't buying everything on the internet. The vast majority of their purchasing was coming from a trip to Walmart or Food Max or you know, equivalent. And when they needed to buy stuff like furniture, which, you know, Amazon sells incredibly large amounts of furniture, they weren't thinking of that. They would, you know, drive into Ethan Allen. All of that changed. That group of people who are typically older people, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, over the last 5 months learned how to use the internet for everything except, you know, books and CDs and DVDs and those sorts of things. And that learning means that the economy has continued to hum forward in a way that most people didn't expect. I didn't expect it. You know, the Federal Reserve didn't expect it. So the bounce back has been quicker. There's only one challenge, though, and the word and the letter K describes it. I absolutely believe that we're not in a V-shaped recovery. That's not true. There's no evidence of that. Doesn't matter which party is saying it, there's no evidence of that. There's actually a lot of evidence that we are in a K-shaped recovery. If you look at the letter K, you look at, okay, it goes straight down, and then it goes up, back up, but it also goes down. And so we were at the point where we went down, and then one portion of the economy, which is the financial sectors, the software services, the non, you know, retail type sector, the non-hospitality sector, they bounced back, and they bounced back very sharply. And so, of course, if you're a Republican, you're saying, hey, there you go. That's your V-shaped recovery. If you're a Democrat, you're like, no. But what about those 10 or 15 million people? Their lives are worse today, much worse today than in March. And that's also true that there's a portion of the economy, the low-end folks, where things have actually gotten worse for them over the last 4 or 5 months. You might say, really? Have they gotten worse? Yes, because in May, they were the recipient of $1,200 per person. So in a family of four, they ended up getting, I don't know, $3,400 if they had two kids. They were the recipients of the fact that even if they were unemployed, their companies couldn't lay them off because companies had to take on PPP loans, and now you couldn't lay off employees. And then they received full unemployment benefits until the end of July, right? And those benefits often were greater than their salary, and they could still work on the side. I got a portion of my home rehabbed in May and June because there were so many workers available who would come and work for me who normally are just completely unavailable, right? But they were still getting a full salary from their employer who couldn't lay them off because they had taken PPP loans. So their situation until the end of July was actually pretty decent, this K group of people. And then things have gone downwards for them because Congress hasn't been able to come up with, you know, something to replace the initial stimulus. So now you have this weird K-shaped recovery, the richer portion of the economy recovering back fairly quickly, and then you have a poorer portion of the economy not recovering. Now, for real estate investors, what does this mean? Well, real estate has always been about the richer people, right? So if you're a single-family investor, what you're buying, basically homes, single-family homes, is usually purchased by the top 50% of the U.S. economy. That hasn't been impacted as much, so nothing has changed for you. Now, if you're on the multifamily side, you do cater to some of these people that are laid off, right? So your apartment complexes have seen an increase in delinquency, and I can definitely say that it's worsening. So, you know, July was pretty good, and then August was a little bit iffy. September's a tiny bit more iffy. We're thinking of looking at October now, and it looks a tiny bit more iffy. It's not horrible, but there's no doubt that month after month, delinquency is creeping upwards, because some of those people that are low on the totem pole can just not afford to pay anymore. And so we're seeing, you know, the net operating income slowly moving down for multifamily. This is also happening in other sectors, right? So obviously the hotels are just decimated. So let's just say, you know, massive fire sales coming and leave it at that. But other sectors like, you know, retail, right? It's very variable for retail. I think that they also are going to be facing a retail apocalypse if you're talking about small strip malls or large superstar malls. All of those are in big trouble. We are seeing very stable numbers, extremely stable numbers for office. And a lot of people are like, that doesn't make sense, Neil. There's nobody in offices. And the answer is the office industry is based on 5 and 10 year leases. And most office tenants are not willing to default on a lease because they have plenty of money in the bank. The average company has 3 months, 6 months, 12 months worth of money in the bank. And so their default rates have been very low. So for the most part, those people have been paying. Some of them are a little bit behind. Some of them have negotiated some, you know, concessions from landlords, but nothing really bad has happened in the office market. And actually, one market has even gotten better, and that's medical offices. And obviously, that makes a lot of sense. That market's gotten better. So we've got this weird sort of situation where multifamily actually has the most amount of exposure to people that are lower on the totem pole. And so if this drags on for months and months and months and we don't get any stimulus, then you might see some, you know, degradation of fundamentals in the multifamily market. And then you'll also start seeing some bad stuff happen in the single family market as more and more of those tenants start to default and landlords have to basically sell their properties for cheap. But I'm not seeing much of it at all on either side yet. Right? So that's where real estate really stands. I mean, huge, huge benefit for everyone in real estate because of the interest rates cuts. And then challenges that they have to deal with in the short term. But I think in the midterm, long term, real estate's a winner because the Fed says low interest rates for 3 years. Well, in a year, if the economy bounces back, now you have 2 years of ultra low interest rates and an economy that's firing on all cylinders a year from now. So I think that, that's kind of my take at this point.
Well, you sold me on the K-shaped recovery. That was pretty interesting. And but Neil, you know, getting back to what you said earlier about 2000, 2008, 2009 with that recession, I mean, the fundamentals were way out of whack back then. Now it's a little bit better. That's certainly a positive, don't you think, as far as the recovery goes?
Absolutely. I think that 2008 is not the kind of recession that we should – we should kind of compare because, to be honest, if I go back 200 years and look at the entire history of the United States, we've never had a recession like this one. This was an enforced recession. The economy was in a good place. Fundamentals were strong. Things were not too expensive like they were in 2007. This was a forced shutdown. And so when we compare it to 2008, that is a false equivalence. That's right. So I think we should just stop. But all I can tell you is that in my world, in the multifamily world, there were $5 billion in transactions last quarter. Okay, $5 billion. And you must say last quarter was the worst of the COVID crisis, right? There's no doubt in my mind that it's the worst quarter. Well, those transactions in the worst quarter in 2008, $1 billion. $1 billion in 2008 because there was no lending in 2008. Today we don't have that issue. We have challenges with lending. There are tweaks that we have to make. There are, you know, things that we're doing that we didn't have to do in March, but we're liquid. The entire industry is liquid. The only part of the industry that is completely illiquid today is new hotel construction. You can't put a gun to a lender's head to get them to give you a loan on new hotel construction. But otherwise, I think that the rest of the real estate industry is pretty robust. And obviously the elections could throw a wrench in it, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's a great topic going forward. Obviously everybody's interested in what's going to happen in the next couple of months and what the deal is with that. What do you see as far as the difference between, let's say, a Trump re-election or a Biden election? What are your thoughts?
Sure. Let me – I'm known for my crazy comments. So here we go, Ron. So here's a crazy comment. The president of the United States is not Donald Trump. The president of the United States is whoever is the chairman of the Fed. This is a Fed-driven economy. Since 2008, what the Federal Reserve does matters way more than what the president does. Now, you can do the math on this. You can hire a bunch of economists. And I think that you'll see the strength of my argument. The Fed is driving the economy at a macro level that is way beyond what the president and the Congress could do even if they were put together. And obviously, that's not the case, right? We have a House that doesn't agree with anything the Senate does. The president has his own ideas and often contradicts his own party. So we've got a situation where the economy is really being tweaked by the Fed, who says, well, look at this dysfunctional Congress. Doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans. They can't get anything done. Let's just tweak the economy in the background because, hey, we don't have anyone to report to, right? The the nice thing, the really awesome thing is that the Fed is not reporting to Congress. The Fed is not reporting to the president. And I don't care if it's Democrats or Republicans. One thing that they always screw up is monetary policy, and the Fed has complete control over it. So once again, my statement is this. The chairman of the Federal Reserve is the president of the United States, especially when it comes to the economy. Right, there's other parts, obviously, that we care about, laws, Supreme Court justices. I'm not saying none of that matters, but my comment was very specific to the economy. So we've got an economic president, and then we've got a president for everything else. So that's the first thing that real estate investors should know, that there's a third party outside there that's controlling this that doesn't have to, you know, they don't have to talk to Biden. Like, if Biden gets elected, he cannot go to the Federal Reserve and say, please raise interest rates. Not that Biden wants to raise interest rates. He wants to cut them. But even if he were to change his mind and say, I want to raise interest rates, he doesn't have any control over it. So the biggest thing that is making the real estate market hot is outside the control of any branch of government. That's the first thing you should understand. The second thing you should know about is this. For the last 4 or 5 decades, real estate has enjoyed phenomenal benefits. These benefits, in my opinion, are totally unfair. The benefits that real estate enjoys, it's almost like it's a protected asset class. And every other asset class looks at real estate and say, why do these guys get all the benefits? And they do. Now, you might say, why is it that real estate gets these benefits? And they get protected regardless of whether Democrats come into power in 2008. They have the House, they have the Senate, they have the presidency. They didn't mess with it, right? And then the Republicans had a lot of control in the last 4 years. And they didn't mess with those benefits. Why is it that real estate doesn't benefit? Why is it that real estate doesn't get hurt? But the biggest reason is senators and congressmen own homes. And their sense of net worth is tied to the net worth of their home. Lots of them own rental real estate. And once again, their sense of net worth is tied back to that rental real estate. So believe it or not, if Biden were to one day declare, okay, let's get rid of the 1031 laws, do you know where the biggest opposition would be? From the Democrats. Not from Republican senators, from Democrats. Now, why is that? Because if you look at the makeup of Congress, the 50 Democrat senators come from rich blue states where more than 50% of total wealth is from real estate, right? And and when you look at them, you know, the Republican governors, they come from other states, and these are not poor states, like place like Dallas. But in a place like Dallas, my sister bought a 5-bedroom home for $320,000. My home in the San Francisco Bay Area is worth $2 million. So who's going to be damaged more if 1031 disappears? It's me, right? So when you look at Democratic senators and Democratic, you know, congressmen and congresswomen, every time you take something away from real estate, you're hurting the Democrats more than you're hurting the Republicans. So it becomes very difficult for Biden to basically do things to hurt real estate directly. What he can do is, if Biden gets elected, is that there can be indirect pain. And one of that is by raising, you know, by getting rid of basically capital gains. He wants to, you know, jack up prices jack up taxes on capital gains. And that can have a significant impact on real estate. My comments there again is there are two scenarios. From what I am seeing, the dysfunction between the Democratic Party, and by the way, I'm on neither side of this debate. I'm an independent myself. I have the same level of disgust for both parties. Don't have any love for either one of them. And, you know, I feel that our system is not dysfunctional. It is one of the most dysfunctional in the entire world at this point in time. So coming at it from there, I'm just looking at it purely from a monetary perspective and what they can achieve. What I can tell you is there's so much dysfunction between the two parties that the only way major tax changes can actually get through Congress today is if the Democrats win control of the Senate, which is a possibility, and Biden wins, and they decide, which is going to be a big one, to get rid of the 60 vote filibuster. Those three check boxes all have to be checked for there to be a radical changes in taxation that could hurt real estate. Are they possible? Well, yeah. I mean, at this point, looking at the polls, I'd give Biden an 85% chance of winning. I'd give Democrats a better than 50% chance of winning the Senate. But if they win the Senate, there's still the 60-vote problem. You can't get major tax changes through without getting enough votes from Republicans. And I can tell you that if they try to get rid of capital gains, not one Republican is going to come over. No matter what they offer, it's not going to happen because that's just dogma for Republicans. So now the only way to get through a huge taxation change is to get rid of the filibuster. So it really comes down to that. And I think that the filibuster is too sacred. I think that there's not going to be enough Democratic votes to get rid of the filibuster, because if they were in the reverse position 6 or 7 years from now, they become completely useless. Right? The filibuster is what keeps balance in American politics. The moment you take it away, the opposition party becomes completely worthless. They might as well go home and come back in 4 years. Right? So in my mind, I don't think that filibuster will go away, which is why I think that what we are going to see from Biden is not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is pandering to his base. People accuse Trump of pandering to his base. Well, Biden does the same thing, right? He's pandering to his base and saying, I'm going to, you know, bring equality. I'm going to take all this money and take it away from the rich and give it to the poor. These are all things that get you elected. But the truth is that if you look at the record of Democratic presidents in the last 25 or 30 years, they haven't really implemented huge reforms. What they have gone after successfully is corporate taxes. Because the percentage of Americans, both Republicans and Democrats, that believe that corporate taxes should be raised is pretty high. So it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. There's a lot of people, 70, 80% of Americans, believe that you can do that. So there's lower resistance there. So there's significant possibility that we could see corporate taxes go from 21%, where they stand today, Trump bought them down, up to 28 or even higher. They could go into the mid-30s. I don't want to talk about whether that's good or bad for the American economy, but I'm not sure if that's bad for real estate because it leaves capital gains alone. So to me, I feel like unless filibuster goes away, 1031 is safe, and so are capital gains, the two things that real estate investors care about the most. Obviously, there's tax. We have some tax benefits, and some of those could also disappear if we kind of move forward with a Democratic administration. But I personally would be sad about that because I benefit from those tax benefits. They're similar to what President Trump is using to pay $750 in taxes. But I don't think it changes the real estate market in the United States. It just means that Neil Bawa is going to end up paying more in taxes. Who cares, right? There's millions and millions of real estate investors. Well, sure, right? But I think the question really here is about whether America should care about this. And I think that, I don't think that those tax benefits are big enough or spread widely enough for it to affect the overall real estate economy. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, but if you affect the capital gains, how does that affect programs like opportunity zones where people are investing into economic development that would eliminate that program? Because why would anybody invest if the capital gains deferment is now gone?
Obviously it would be catastrophic for opportunity zones. But, Vicky, I think it's a good program. But even if we were to take President Trump's, the administration's overly bullish number on its impact, $50 billion, please note that the U.S. real estate market is over $10 trillion. So this isn't even, a fraction of 1%. So when I look at that, and by the way, that's the most bullish assumption that anyone else has made. There's lots of more reasonable assumptions that it makes. It has a smaller, impact. So bottom line is, in the big picture, yes, that program could be hurt, But keep in mind, people invest in opportunity zones for more than tax deferment. Opportunity
right.
zones is a de facto tax forgiveness program, forgiveness of tax. So there
right.
will still be plenty of people that will invest in it because of forgiveness, definitely less than people today because they're getting deferral and forgiveness. So one of those two pieces get taken away. So, yes, I do think that if you look at real estate, the area that would be probably the most challenged is going to be opportunity zones because it's really dependent on the capital gains, you know, number staying pretty low. And there's a good chance it's going to go up because the truth is this. Taxes have to go up anyway. You know, we just had, for the first time, a Republican president in a 3% unemployment economy with $1 billion a year in deficit, right? Sorry, $1 trillion a year in deficit. This has never happened before. So it doesn't matter who's in office, a Democrat president or a Republican president, we're at the point where our tax receipts don't meet what we're spending. And again, Republicans control the Senate, and still we're unable to bring that deficit down below a trillion. So common sense says it doesn't matter whether Republicans are in office or Democrats are in office, taxes have to go up. And you know, simply saying, well, we will just do it via growth, I think that after 8 years of the Bush era and 4 years of the Trump era, it's a little hollow. Less people, even amongst Republicans, are willing to believe that growth is the solution to our billion or trillion dollar deficits. So I think that more taxes are inevitable. Obviously, more taxes come quicker under a Democratic administration.
Yeah, Neil, after what you just said before, it's my takeaway on this that I guess the overview is it doesn't matter who wins the election. Our real estate investors really shouldn't be losing too much sleep over the results of this.
I wouldn't be. Yeah, I think if you were opportunity zone investors, I would be losing sleep. Because there's a good chance that capital gains will go up. But if they choose to target, remember, if they don't win the Senate, right, which there's still a pretty good chance that the Democrats will not win the Senate, I wouldn't lose any sleep whatsoever. Because they'll have to battle the Republicans and everything. I think capital gains issues will fall by the wayside. The Republicans will probably cut a deal on corporate taxes. Right?
So they
might go back to where they were before with Obama, right? So they've had 4 years of low corporate taxes. They've had 4 years of huge foreign tax benefits. Well, now the pendulum swings, and the Democrats basically put it back to where it was before. I think that that's what the Republicans will probably accept. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, that's the good news.
And it goes back to what you said, too, Neil, that it all goes back to the Fed. Who controls the money, which controls everything that no matter what you're doing, regardless, it still goes back to the Fed who controls the money.
That's right. And you know what? One funny thing is, and this is a shocking thing for Republicans sometimes when they hear this, right? Once again, I'm not in this debate. As far as I'm concerned, you know, both parties can go to hell as far as my personal philosophy is considered. But please note that Goldman Sachs, right, by the way, Goldman Sachs is the smartest bank in America. If you study what happened in 2008, they were the one that came out on top because these are very sharky, smart people, right? So you talk to Goldman Sachs, and they just set out an analysis, which is very detailed, that says more jobs will be created by Biden. And Republicans are, no, you know, Biden won't create any jobs. Yes, because he's going to spend your money. He's going to spend your money. He's going to drive up the deficit. And because, you know, Democrats don't have any problems driving up deficits, he's going to drive up the deficit and spend more money than Republicans. So if you spend hundreds of billions of dollars more, won't you create some jobs? And I'm not talking about the ethics of it. By taking borrowing money to create jobs may not be an ethical activity. But you know as well as I do that that's what the Democrats will do. So job creation post-election may be much stronger than most people think. And we'll spend the next 4 years debating the ethics of whether we should use borrowed money to create jobs. But that's what they're planning to do. That's what they're clearly saying they're going to do. So you know, I don't think that that job creation will be weaker. Goldman Sachs doesn't seem to think so.
Yeah.
Well, the question is, do you create more jobs with lower taxes to invest in businesses to create more jobs, or do you create more jobs by raising taxes and giving money out so businesses and the economy can grow that way? Which is the better way? That would be the question.
Well, I think that if you ask the question specifically that way, the answer is obvious. I think that when you borrow money to create jobs, that's a short-term effect, and it slows the economy in the long run because debt slows everything down. So the methodology of cutting taxes is superior, right? Every economist in the world would agree on that. The point is that the detail, you know, it's all about the details. If you look at the tax cuts that have been made in the last, I don't know, 16, 7, or I would say since 2001, so that's about 19 years, there's a very strong argument that Wall Street has benefited greatly from those tax cuts, and there's a very weak argument that Main Street has benefited from it. Therefore, the argument has to be that when rich people get richer, there's a trickle-down effect so that money comes down to poor people. Now, over the last 19 years, economists haven't actually found any trickle-down effect. Even the Congressional Budget Office, which obviously right now is a little partial to Republicans. They have to issue these bullish updates. Even they haven't found any proof. So the bottom line is tax cuts that go to people who desperately need to spend money today appear to have a bullish impact. Tax cuts that go to the pocket of the rich basically end up being not being reinvested. People say that people will reinvest them, but what we've actually seen is that the bank accounts of the rich have gotten bigger. And that money that sits in those bank accounts, it's not productive money. So, Vicky, productive money is what's needed. Productive money is money that is invested. Productive money is money that has leverage against it. If it sits in a bank account or if it sits in real estate, it's not as productive. And you might say, why is that real estate money not productive? Well, if that rich guy goes and buys, you know, existing real estate, all he's doing is driving up the prices of real estate and making it impossible for people to buy homes. And until the 90s, or actually even into the early 2000s, the biggest asset that Americans had was their home. That was a big portion of their net worth. Now that less and less people can afford homes, you have a situation where the rich are denying the poor from owning the biggest asset they could have. And that's why you see that the middle class strength is vanishing. So the answer to your question, once again, going back to it, was cutting taxes is a superior methodology than borrowing money. The implementation of that methodology in the last 20 years has been different from what the Republicans used to do before. So it seems that right now it requires a trickle-down effect because an overwhelming majority of the tax cuts go to people who don't need them. They don't spend the money immediately. So that's why I think one of the things that Congress did that I really applaud was that in March, they just spent $1,200 to everybody that's not making $99,000. And you notice that it buoyed the economy. The recovery has been much faster than most people because, it wasn't that, if I got $1,200 and somebody who makes $8 an hour got $1,200, that has a much better impact, right? What did I do with my $1,200? Just so you know, I put it in the bank. I didn't do anything with it.
Exactly. You didn't
spend it. It came in. I put it in the bank. I moved on, right, with my life. But the guy that got the $1,200 in March immediately spent it on rent and food. So it had a very significant impact. However, the last 20 years' worth of tax benefits have not been like that. So they've been progressive tax benefits, or I should say regressive in this case, where the people that need them the most receive the smallest amount of money, though they receive the largest percentage. So this debate can continue on for decades, obviously, Republicans and Democrats. My viewpoint is this, that there hasn't been much evidence of the trickle-down theory working. And that's the argument that the Democrats make. They've got a deeply flawed method of we'll just borrow money and spend it, nonsensical. But then the alternative there may, in fact, actually be worse, shockingly.
Yeah. Yeah, and Neil, I want to close this out with one more question for you. You guys do a lot of real estate syndications. What are syndicators doing these days in the days of COVID? Are they thriving?
We're slowing down. I think that our job is to buy multifamily properties that were built in the 70s and the 80s. And these are pigs, and we're putting a lot of lipstick on these pigs, some mascara and high shadow, and making them look nicer and raising the rents and giving returns to our investors. It's a tried and tested methodology. Tens of thousands of teams have done it. The challenge today is the prices have not gone down. But the interest rates on bridge loans, short-term loans that we take while we're improving the properties, those have spiked upwards, right? So remember that muddy, you know, piece that I was talking about. So we have to now take higher interest rates. Now, if our properties are in a place where we can take 10-year fixed loans, we don't need a bridge loans, oh my God, they're cheap, right? Under 3% for 10-year loans. But the multifamily industry, the syndication industry, thrives on taking bridge loans and then refinancing after 2 or 3 years when they've raised income. We can't do that today easily because the interest rates are much higher. So that's the pros and cons there. There are certainly more challenges there for the multifamily industry. The only benefit that I can point to is that new construction projects, interest rates have fallen a great deal. And so it's actually now easier to do new construction. The only challenge is less banks are lending in that space. Even with the lower interest rates, we've got less banks that are lending. So it's an interesting sort of situation. We're not doing a lot of value-add projects. We're slowing down. But we expect to speed up in the coming months as we expect the economy to start getting closer to normal. It's going to take a while, but it's going to start getting closer to normal. Each quarter of this COVID era will be better than the previous quarter. It just might not be as quick as most people think it is going to be.
Yeah, how do real estate investors find these projects that you're working on? Your website, or what do they do?
I think the best way to engage with us is through Multifamily University. So you can just type in the word Multifamily University into Google, hit enter, and you'll see about 25 webinars that we do. And you'll also notice that the people that are going to these webinars also get invited to occasional webinars where we talk about our projects. And so there's, you know, I'd say there's way more people that attend our webinars than attend the project webinars because not everyone's interested in investing. But that's really the right way, because what you want to know is before you give a syndicator $100,000 of your hard-earned money is, what's their philosophy? What do they think? What do they believe? How are they acting? What are their methods? And so I think that is the right way for anyone to do due diligence, because when I'm delivering a free webinar, right, I'm going to be less guarded with the way I think than I will when I'm talking about a deal. So that's the best way to learn more about our projects.
Yeah, I know. For myself, it's just like I told you at the start of the podcast. I put it down on my calendar, and I look forward to them like I would, a baseball game or a presidential debate or something. Hey, you know, Neil's thing is on at 5 o'clock today. I can't wait. So they're really, really great stuff. I really enjoy it, and I get a lot of good information from them all. And even today in this podcast, I'm writing my notes here on what you're saying, and the pen's running out of ink. It's just. It's always a pleasure having you on, Neil. You have some great information every single time. It's great.
I just come because you guys let me rant. So
Well, that's because we can't get a word in edgewise, Neil.
Oh, my wife says that too. You know, I wonder why.
But all what right, you please. Say is so interesting. It's worth it. It's absolutely worth it.
And we have.
Well, I'm glad.
We haven't even touched upon the debt jubilee. We'll have to do that in another podcast, right?
I think that's I'm not talking about debt jubilee before an election. We can talk about it post-election if you like.
Exactly.
It's too hot.
All right. Well, listen, Neil, like I said, thanks again for being on the podcast. Really appreciate it. Vicky, thanks for co-hosting. This was a really great episode as usual. And, folks, you're listening to the Mappable USA podcast at mappableusa.com. If you go there, you scroll down, you'll see all our syndication sources, which are growing every single week. We got some more up there. And you pick the one you like the best, and you'll never miss another one of our episodes. If you want to be a guest on the show like Neil was today, there's a guest tab there. Fill that out. We'll see what we can do about getting you on the show. And if you like what you hear today, send us an email, info@mappableusa.com, or just comment on the page that you're listening to this on right now. We appreciate all your support, your help, your listenership, and we'll be back at you next week with another Mappable USA episode. Thanks a lot, everyone. Have a great week.